Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello. Happy Monday and welcome to an hour of Mind Power. This is Donna Sebo, and we're going to be talking about a movie star today. Yes, who is it? Well, his name is Len Lesser. But Len passed away a year ago, and I have a book in front of me that's titled Where's the Watch? Now, for those of you that watch Seinfeld, this is Uncle Leo that we're going to be talking about. Tama Ryder is my guest today, and Tama is the person that took on the project of putting this book together about Len Lesser's life. Tama, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Donna. Pleasure.
Now, I really find it fascinating how actors, actresses, people of well-known positionings in whatever profession they're in, frequently they're very, very private, and they just don't let anybody write about them. How did you, because you are a writer who grew up without a television, I love that description, and you have written an award-winning documentary about the Fresh Air Fund program, and
yes,
you've worked for some politicians, and you really have a passion for writing. How in the world did you ever link up with Len, and what was it that created this chemistry? I know you're just a doll. You're just as cute as you can be. And he was how old when you met him for the first time?
He was, he was 86 years old.
Yep, you still can't trust them when they're in their 80s. Believe me, I know. I know that.
Exactly.
And exactly right. And he was quite a guy, but he's such a personality. And I can remember when I heard the name, it didn't really register with me. And then as soon as I saw his face, and I think a lot of people are that way, they'll remember the face or they'll remember a particular role that someone played. But they may not always remember the name if this isn't what you'd consider a superstar.
Right, so exactly.
He's a character actor. He was a character actor. He died a year ago.
Yes.
But tell us how you crossed each other's paths and what in the world ever possessed you to decide to write a story about this fascinating man.
Well, actually, he was at a time in his life where he wanted to share his story. And he was about to work with another writer who I knew in Los Angeles. And that writer could not do the project. Something else came along. And he mentioned the project to me, and he told me that he was working with Len Lesser. And I didn't know his name either. And then he said he is Uncle Leo on Seinfeld. And I did know the character. At that point, I had only watched one episode of Seinfeld, because, as you said, I grew up without a television. And so, but I said, oh, I would love to meet him. And so we met, and we clicked. Len interviewed me and sort of asked me how I would lay out the book and what I thought about his life. And I told him, honestly, that I wasn't very familiar with it. I didn't know his work, and I knew I had Googled him, so I knew before our interview that he had been in hundreds of films, hundreds of television shows. He was still acting on the stage throughout the world. And I told him that, and I said, look, I don't really know a lot about you, but I am fascinated by your life. And we hit it off, and he liked the fact that I was just about to familiarize myself with his work and that I would kind of learn about his work through him telling me about it. Mm-hmm. And that was it. And the next day, we got together, and I started interviewing him, and that was it, and we were off and running.
Ed Asner wrote the foreword to the book, and Ed Asner is a man that's played so many different roles. He's also, I consider, a character actor. And I think through much of his career, there may have been times where they typecast him, but Ed Asner was with Mary Tyler Moore, and he just has such a career. And to find out that these two men have been friends for over 40 years was really quite an interesting perspective, because, I don't know, most people, when they think of Hollywood movie stars, it's like, well, they're living in an ivory tower on some hill in some place in California or New York or wherever, and they don't, you know, they never come down to the common folk level. But that's really one of the things that comes across in your book, that Len was really a guy that absolutely had a passion for acting, just absolutely loved it.
He did. He did, and that's what he and Ed have in common, and had in common. They had never worked together, but they, when they met, they were both character actors. They were working actors, and they had that in common. They had that passion in common. They also had in common the fact that they had both gone to college at an early age. Actually, Len held degrees in economics and government. He graduated from college when he was 19. And then went on. First, he enlisted, and he served our country for many years. And then ultimately, he came out, and he had this great passion, and he went on to graduate school and studied acting, and really honed his craft, and was passionate about it for 65 years. I mean, he was just constantly working, and he was auditioning. Literally, you mentioned he passed away a year ago. He was literally working. He was doing a new show in Toronto. He was on the stage there, and he was auditioning and doing what he always did, because that's what drove him in life.
Now, one of the fascinating aspects about Len is that he had a house in Burbank, and I used to live in Burbank, and a lot of these places have been around since the Second World War. And he had lived there. He was just totally, without any flash or drama about his life. And he had purchased that house a lot of years ago, and that's where he lived. I bet you a lot of his neighbors didn't even know who he was.
Yes, you're absolutely right, Donna. He purchased the house in 1962. At one point he was able to leave, and he could have bought a bigger house, because this was also a very small house. This was a two-bedroom house that he lived in. And he had a family, and but he loved the house, and he loved the neighborhood, and he never wanted to leave it. He was very active in the Burbank community. He volunteered in the public schools. And he just, this is where he was most comfortable. And no, a lot of his neighbors did not know what he did. Actually, neighbors who did know what he did were the Howards. Ron Howard's parents were longtime neighbors down the street, and they were all actually in acting class together. Ron's parents and Len and Len's wife, who was also an actress. So it was actually Len who first saw Ronnie, and Ron was in Len's acting class, and one point, Ron came in when he was about 4 years old and did a little scene, and Len said, "Get this kid out of here. He's too good." But, and of course, Ron Howard went on and had a great career, and Len was very proud of him. But they were the neighbors who did know about what Len did, but the rest of them, no. I don't think that they were really aware of who their neighbor was.
I think this side of, let's call it the movie star's life, is something many, many people don't realize. The acting environment is always a very precarious one. It is something, many times, you have to know the right person, you have to be in the right place at the right time. Serendipity seems to be very strongly associated with it. But I loved how you opened up the book, how he got his very first rejection from his rabbi.
Exactly.
And that after, you've got to share that with, because here he is. He didn't know that this is what's going to be the passion of his life. When you think of someone living into their 80s, in the middle 80s, and you go back to where they began, that's the last thing that I think he ever would have considered. Tell us a story about the rabbi and how that happened.
Yeah. Well, Len had just a very, very, I guess, traumatic bar mitzvah, and he was meant to learn Hebrew, and he really struggled with it, and ultimately he just tried to kind of memorize what he needed to read for his bar mitzvah. But he called actually this rabbi autonomy, he referred to him as Yiddish Yoda, this very learned man. And he, but Len basically, you know, just tried to kind of, you know, do this, and he sort of just froze up, and he had a terrible time, and he suddenly, you know, was very embarrassed and humiliated in front of his congregation. Because his rabbi sort of said, no, you must read the words during this ceremony, and Len just couldn't do it. But he realized at that time that he really did have a passion for performing, and that he could perform, and that he could do this, that he just, I don't know, he suddenly realized that he could stand up and do these things, and he was just 13 years old then. But it was a bit of a traumatic experience for him, and but in some ways, kind of a turning point. And later he went on and he sort of did some acting in high school, and he realized, you know what, even if I'm not great, I just enjoy this, and I want to keep doing this. And he had a lot of experiences like that. He talks about Lee Strasberg, who he studied with, and Uta Hagen, and at one point he was in class with Uta Hagen, and she was teaching he and Geraldine Page, who was in that class, and Lee Marvin. And Lee and Geraldine were great at that time, and Len just really felt he couldn't keep up. But he liked that because he thought that would drive him to be a better actor. But they all, you know, at the beginning even of his life, a lot of people said, you know what, this guy is better being a stage manager, not an actor. So he had a lot of experiences early on where, from the rabbi to Uta Hagen saying, maybe this is not great for you to be out in public and performing. And he kept saying, no, I want to pursue it.
Well, I think it's fascinating how little series of circumstances lead people into directions of their career positioning, if you will. And one of the things that was significant with Len is that when he enlisted in the Army, and I'm just going to quote your paragraph, I finally enlisted in the Army as a private mainly because they were taking anyone who had a pulse. I went to the recruiting office near Grand Central Station for medical and psychological exams. Enlistees like myself wore a blue armband so we didn't have to wait in long lines and were ushered right in. And I just thought, just the statement they were taking anybody that had a pulse, to me, was just phenomenal. And he was like so many other young men, that was exactly it. And his comment about the reason you do it is because you look good in a uniform, and the ladies like him. And that is so true even today. I don't know what it is with the uniforms.
Right.
But then he had a sergeant that really had such a particular personality. He used that sergeant and that sergeant's persona for his own acting career. He had this knack of being able to pick up on different people that he was around, and he'd incorporate them into whatever characters he was going to be playing. That's a real talent.
It is. It is. And I think it's really what people responded to in all of his roles. You know, I think a lot of people obviously know him as Uncle Leo. A lot of people know him also later in life as Garvin on Everybody Loves Raymond. They're very relatable characters. There's something about both those older gentlemen that people can kind of relate to. But I think his early roles, too, The Outlaw Josie Wales, where he played the role of Abe, it was a role that Clint Eastwood asked him to play, and you know, he was able to kind of do this accent, and he was very good at doing just, you know, what you're saying, Donna, where he really studied people and he kind of, you know, took little things from them and was kind of able to use that when he was playing these, you know, these real characters, and he was always sort of cast in you know, sort of these kind of tangential roles, but they were quite meaty roles where he, I think, felt that he could really showcase his skills.
Well, I just loved it when he shared the story about how, while he was in the military, he ends up being sent over to India. And there's an elderly Hindu man in a small canoe that comes up to the ship, and he greets him in Yiddish. And he said, who is this Hindu man speaking Yiddish in India? He couldn't believe it. And I thought, that's hysterical. I mean, that is really hysterical, because it's the last thing you would expect someone to say.
Exactly.
This Hindu man, the new Yiddish. And he said,
exactly.
From Bronx, you know, to being in Bombay, India. I mean, there's so many of these stories in the book. And then his experience with the cobra. That was really an interesting one, too. But he had a lot of, you might say, what would it be, chutzpah in Jewish?
Definitely. A lot of nerve, a lot of moxie.
Yes, he had a lot of that. And he begged to be sent into combat. Now, anybody that's in the military, someone saying, send me into combat, they really think you're nuttier than a fruitcake.
Mm-hmm.
But he did it. He said he couldn't go back to the Bronx and tell them he was a mail clerk. He said that's downright embarrassing. So, I mean, all of these stories about his time and the various things that he went through before he was able to go to New York, because he wanted to be an actor more than anything else.
Yes, he did. He did. And, you know, and throughout his career, I mean, even, you know, early on after he was in these classes, as I mentioned, with Geraldine Page and Lee Marvin, he was on the stage in New York, and then Lee Marvin was the first one in his class to get an agent to go out to Hollywood, and he made it right away, Lee. Lee told Len to come out to Hollywood. He said, Len, come on out here. And actually, Lee Marvin picked Len up at the airport and drove him to meet his agent, who didn't want to represent Len. And then Len ended up going on a bunch of different auditions and all these things. And Len was so close. Actually, one of his first roles, he was meant to play a pretty large role in Rebel Without a Cause. And his agent just kind of botched the deal, and he wasn't able to be in that film. And years later, and I talk about just a few years after that, he had an amazing interview with Alfred Hitchcock, and he was meant to be in The Man Who Knew Too Much, another really famous film. And his agent, the same one, botched that deal as well. So he had a lot of things early on, too. Once he left New York and he moved to Hollywood, he had Lee Marvin getting him these auditions, helping him out, and yet it was still so difficult because he just had a lot of bad luck and a lot of bad timing, and he just had to keep going.
That's one of the things that you mention in the book. His statement was that he would be on the hoof for 7-8 hours a day,
mm-hmm.
and he would just continue and continue and continue. What did he do in between? What kind of work did he do in between the gigs?
Yeah, well, he talks about it in the book. He talks about his time. He worked in a tire factory. He worked as a dishwasher. He would just take odd jobs because he did need to pay his bills. And as I mentioned, he had a family. He and his wife had actually tried for many years to have children. Len really wanted children, and he was not able to have children, and he ended up adopting two children. Those children were also his life, and so he needed, in between obviously working, he needed to make money, and so he was doing these other jobs and then auditioning. And he did that really throughout his years, where even when he was actually on Seinfeld at that time, he was able to just be an actor and pay his bills doing acting. But he actually had to turn down gigs on Seinfeld because he was a recurring character, but he didn't have a contract. So some shows, Jerry Seinfeld would call him to come and do a show, and Len would say, look, I already booked a film, for the next, you know, month or two or three, mm-hmm. and I can't be on Seinfeld. I can't do the show. So he was in 15 episodes of Seinfeld, but he was actually meant to be in many, many more, and they had to write Uncle Leo out of those scripts.
Amazing.
But that's what Len had to do. And so, you know, later in life when he was acting and he was able to book a lot of those gigs, he just booked things one after another. So it just kept him busy and it kept him paying the bills.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of his favorite teachers is Konstantin Stanislavski. And the two books that Konstantin wrote, mm-hmm. An Actor Prepares and Building a Character.
Mm-hmm.
Really, he said he never mastered the technique, but it really went a long way towards him building character. And that was something, too. He was in classes.
Mm-hmm.
He would always look at ways that he could hone his craft.
Yes. Yes, he did. I mean, you know, what you're mentioning, I mean, that was, you know, kind of considered the method. And Len had studied this and really studied someone like Marlon Brando. And at one point, you know, Len says he thought he would be Brando from the Bronx because he was so serious about the craft, about acting. And he was constantly learning and seeking knowledge. And he really thought early on that he could be Marlon Brando because he felt that he was really, that he was so serious, and that his colleagues took him very seriously, I must say. The reason that Lee Marvin was so keen on helping Len was because Lee believed that Len was really a great actor.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout the years, Clint Eastwood, they had worked together on Kelly's Heroes, and he sought out Len for the role in The Outlaw Josie Wales. Dustin Hoffman, on the set of Papillon, Len was meant to have a very large role in Papillon. Unfortunately, that role ended up literally on the cutting room floor. But Dustin Hoffman said, "Wow, Len, you're amazing," and actually went to the director and said, "Len Lesser is just an amazing actor." Walter Matthau, another person who also said, "Wow, you're just an incredible talent." So he really had the respect of all these people. And just as I mentioned Jerry Seinfeld before calling Len, he had initially called Len to do the role of Uncle Leo because he had seen Jerry Seinfeld and Larry David and Larry Charles grew up watching Len on television. They had watched him on That Girl with Marlo Thomas, and they loved him as kids. And they said as soon as they were thinking about an Uncle Leo, they said, "We need to cast Len Lesser. There's no question." Len didn't know that, of course, until later, and he thought that he had to really audition, and he did audition for the part, and he was always nervous that he was going to get killed off on that show because he felt that all of his characters were always killed off or brought to justice, so he never thought that that Uncle Leo would kind of continue for as long as he did. He was always surprised. But all these people really did believe in Len's talent, and he really was a remarkable actor.
Well, Hollywood for him was just absolutely wonderful, even though he loved the theater and New York was so significant. He even did work with the original Metropolitan Opera group, the New York Opera group, and
yes, that
is a scene in there that's priceless. I mean, I won't give it away, but it is absolutely priceless. He knew that he wasn't meant to be a director. You think of some people who have been actors or actresses, and they've gone on, you know, like Barbara Streisand, she got into directing. You have
mm-hmm.
Clint Eastwood. You have Ron Howard. You have so many people that were so well recognized by millions around the world mm-hmm. for their acting. And then they decided to want to be directors. But Len knew that that was not something that he wanted to do at all. Alfred Hitchcock, this was someone that he crossed paths with, but he crossed paths with Michael Landon, Ronald Reagan. For all that we hear about in show business, it's really quite a tight group, isn't it?
It is. It really is. Yeah, it's pretty remarkable, actually.
Mm-hmm. And that's something, too, that I think it's difficult for us to realize. And when someone is going into the acting environment. And that's one thing I think if Len were here, I'd want him to answer. What is it in having written this book and with the experiences that you've had with various people in this industry as you were putting the material together, what do you think makes someone like Len, who's a character actor, he never became the super-duper movie star, but this man, what he accomplished and what he was able to do in all of the films, the Broadway shows, the other things that he was in, what would you say to someone who says, I want this more than I want food, but I can't make anything work? What do you think you'd want to tell them?
I think that it's just one of these things where ultimately for Len, he found his life's calling in doing this, and Len was someone who never measured his success in dollars. He measured it by his own personal fulfillment, and I think that acting was what drove him for his entire life. And I think that what he did tell a lot of young people was just that if it was something, whatever it is, and in this case, you know, if someone wanted to act, that they just really needed to have that passion and to want to do it. And it's interesting because Jerry Stiller was at my book launch, and he said, actually, just touching on the opera reference, he remembered when he was actually an extra at one time for that, and Len had gotten parts for Jerry Stiller and Ann Mira back in the day. But Stiller mentioned this, and Asner mentioned it, and Len used to talk about it, and it was just that all these guys really, they just had a passion for this, and it's just what, you know, it's just what they live and breathe every day, and they want to, you know, they want to perform, they wanted to be on stage, and I think in Len's case, he was very happy doing it.
Now, as he got older, it seemed like the roles got even better for him. I would think it's the opposite, but things have changed in our world. It used to be the older actors were sent out to pasture, and nobody bothered with them. Occasionally, once in a while, you know, like a Barrymore might have a chance, but most of the time, they just dumped you. And today we have such a diversity that a lot of the actors, they're older and they're in demand. And that's what happened with Len.
Yes. He was thrilled by it. And what was funny with Len, too, and I think that was part of it, is that he didn't see himself as being old.
Mm-hmm.
So even, as I said, when I met him, he was 86 years old. He thought of himself as a much younger man, and I even thought of him as a much younger man because of that. So I think that he was thrilled by the fact that that he had been called and sort of singled out for the role in Seinfeld, and he was originally meant to be cast in the role of Ray Romano's father in Everybody Loves Raymond, and that's a whole other part of a chapter in his book, but he did take on the role of the friend, and after that, he was cast in a lot of things. But I think that he felt, in some ways, that he had gotten better with age, and so he felt that he was at the best and kind of in his prime. And he got Seinfeld when he was 68 years old, and I think that he felt, hey, you know, I've really hit my stride now.
Yes. Well, for those of you, if you love anything associated with Hollywood, if you know of someone that has a passion for acting, thinks that this is the world they'd like to be involved with, I really think the book Where's the Watch regarding Len Lesser, and he's Jerry Seinfeld's Uncle Leo. If you recognize the character, then you'll know who we're talking about. And Tama Ryder, you did a wonderful job with this man's stories. I just think that the photos and everything that are in this book are just marvelous. And I especially enjoy the picture of the two of you together, and he's holding the book. He got to see the book before he passed away, which I think is absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, he was a great man, and I think that you know, his life is just fascinating, and he really he taught me a lot. I can say that. I only knew him for a few years, but I felt very honored to write his story.
Now, what's your website, Tana, so that people can find out more about the book and you?
Yes, my website is tamarider.com, TAMARYDER.com.
Well, it's been a delight having you as a guest. I wish you the best. I think that kids in high school would just love this, or even students in college in the theater, because this is a real story about a real man who had successes and failures and ended up, after the age of 68, becoming a star in a way he would never, ever have imagined, with his wonderful character, Uncle Leo. Thank you, Tamara, for being my guest today. TamaraRyder.com. Check it out. I think you'll find it absolutely fascinating. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about the side effects? Are you having trouble getting to sleep at night because of the pain? Well, I'm Lou Paradise. I had the same problems you have, cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Toprasin, pain relief and healing cream. Toprasin relieves pain without the side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain. But don't take my word for it. Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Toprasin and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you. We know you hurt. We want to help. We are so sure that Toprasin will work for you, we offer a money-back guarantee. So if you want the pain relief without the side effects, ask for Toprasin. Toprasin is available at Duane Reade, Quick Check Pharmacies, and Wegmans. Ask for Toprasin or call 1-800-959-1007 for a store near you. That's 1-800-959-1007. Toprasin, the last pain medicine you'll ever need, and you can sleep on that.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com. and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. I'm so delighted you're able to be with me today. And if you'd like to give me a buzz, all you have to do is call me up at 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And I'll light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. I wanted to share with you a quote by Arthur H. Vandenberg. He said, "It is less important to redistribute wealth than it is to redistribute opportunity." Let me read that again. "It is less important to redistribute wealth than it is to redistribute opportunity." That is so true. If you have opportunity, you can step up and you can create your own wealth. But if you don't have opportunity, then you feel like you're stuck. And there are so many places in the world where people honestly don't have opportunities. And I can remember talking with people years back who had survived the Cultural Revolution in China. And when they were in China, when they were living in China, and they were Chinese, they said, we did not have a right to choose anything. We were told what we were going to do. And there wasn't food available. Clothing was very difficult to come by. The impoverished conditions that they lived in were just hideous. And they managed to survive. So in that cycle in Chinese history, started evolving away as soon as they could, in whatever fashion they possibly could take the opportunity to reach for. They got out. They got away. But a lot of people, millions, were never able to do that. But those that did had stories to tell. And the one thing that they would say over and over again is, there was no place to go. There was nothing to choose from. And they were nothing better than slaves of the dictatorship that presided over the lives of so many millions. And I think it's important for us to realize that that's one of the greatest things about the United States. My husband had the opportunity to chat with a young Ethiopian woman who is working towards getting her citizenship here in the United States. She left Ethiopia. When the door opened for her to come to the United States, she took it immediately. There was no hesitation, because in Ethiopia, as a woman, there was no opportunity. She said, I really wouldn't have been able, due to the discrimination procedures that are over there and the economic environment, there was not going to be the opportunity for her to get the education. And she's working in a Starbucks. And she said, I love it. I would never have had this opportunity. She treasures the fact that she has been able to make that step forward, to be able to invest in herself. And she said, I know here I have a chance. I can have a business of my own if I want. I can educate myself. I have the freedom to do so. And I think that that is something that we really need to pay attention to. If ever you have an opportunity to talk to people that have survived excruciating conditions and circumstances from other parts of the world, you'll never forget it. And then you'll be able to count the blessings that you have right here, right now. It really makes a difference how you work with your attitude, how you make that attitude work for you in a way so that you do not become a victim. You become empowered and you take charge of your space. Male or female, it doesn't make any difference. What's important is that you do for yourself what you know you need to do. And if you eat peanut butter and crackers for a few months, okay, so that's what you eat. I don't know why people seem to think that we're supposed to have everything or that one is entitled to everything. You're going to have to earn it. You really are. And you know what you're earning when you go through the tough times and you're willing to work with them? You say, I don't like it. None of us like castor oil. But if that's something that was necessary for our health and well-being, we'd take it. Edgar Casey found a good use for it. That's castor oil packs. However, you may decide that, gee, something's not worth fighting for. How much are you willing to give the best of what you've got, so that whatever your dream is has a chance of being realized? It's a funny thing about life. Dreams are not always going to be, well, how can I say it? Recognized, number one, for the opportune form that they can be taken and put into action with. But I do think we have to understand we may not be in exactly the right place at the right time. Like Len Lesser wasn't. But he kept pursuing it. And the success that he enjoyed through the years, as well as the failures, all ended up just making his life even richer and better as he got older. And I think that that's something we need to remember. Life is what we make of it in the now, right here, right now. So if you got a pity pot around, give it about 15 minutes worth of attention and then move on. You don't want to get stuck there. Donna Sebo here. Telephone number to call in and chat with me is 888-627-6008. 1-800-926-0008. Well, I want to share a spooky story with you. It's about a voice from the grave. Now, I have to tell you, this isn't the only story I've ever heard like this. But this occurred in 1977, and it was on February the 21st. Now, a woman by the name of Teresita Bassa, she was stabbed to death in her apartment in Chicago. And the murderer threw a mattress on top of her lifeless body and set it on fire to destroy evidence of the crime. Well, 2 weeks later, a fellow worker of Teresita's said to someone and was, I guess, trying to joke, and the person's name was Rima Chua, if there's no solution to her murder, she can come to me in a dream. That's what the guy said. Well, it wasn't too long after he made that statement. He happened to fall asleep in a chair in a hospital locker room, and he awakened, finding Teresita was standing right in front of her. Now, Rimi began to have some experiences. And one day, while she was at work, she was standing next to a fellow orderly at the hospital, Alan, and she began to experience a panic attack. 5 months after this visitation from Teresita, Rimi began speaking in Spanish. Rimi didn't know how to speak Spanish, but she was being very fluent. When Rimi was questioned, she said, "I am Teresita Bassa. Nothing has been done about the man who killed me." This is what came out of Rimi's mouth. Teresita named her killer and would often appear to ask Rimi's husband if he had gone to the police yet. Now, Jose said that he hadn't because they had no proof, and the voice that came out of Rimi said, "Dr. Chua, the man Alan Showery, stole my jewelry and gave it to his girlfriend. They lived together." Remember the orderly I mentioned that had been standing behind beside her and she started going into a panic attack? Mm-hmm. That's the guy that killed her. Well, Jose finally telephoned the Evanston police headquarters, and Showery was brought in for questioning. Now, Alan Showery got very, very nervous, changed his story several times, but denied he had done the crime. Now, the interviewers next went to his girlfriend and asked if this man, Alan, had given her any jewelry. She said, "Oh, sure." She showed them an antique cocktail ring and accompanied them to the station with her jewelry box. Two of Teresita's friends identified some of the pieces at Teresita's, and Showery eventually acknowledged that he was guilty of the murder. Mm-hmm. This isn't the only story I've ever heard about a situation like this. There was a couple that happened to be visiting a particular town, and the wife all of a sudden started acting very strangely and went down to some rocks. And she ended up having an accident down at the rocks, and she drowned. Well, the husband was put into jail. They accused him of murdering her. Well, he had been in jail for a few years, and he was innocent. This would have been totally an accident. Well, as it turned out, there was a couple a few years later. This innocent man is sitting in jail, and there's this couple that drives by this particular area, and his wife begins acting strangely and starts talking, and he said it wasn't even his wife, and it was the spirit of the woman that had drowned, and she was using this woman to say, "My husband is innocent. This is what happened." So they ended up going to the police, and everything that was told, and these are two perfect strangers, just happened to be in the area. They go to the police. The man eventually was released from prison because he was innocent. And the spirit talked about how she had been acting very strangely, and she was very upset with her husband. That's why she was acting weirdly. but she had slipped on the rocks and he had not murdered her, and she didn't want him punished because he was innocent. They saw the woman who was possessed by the spirit of this woman who had died, and once everything was cleared up, the young woman went back to normal. She said it was the strangest thing. She didn't remember an item of what had happened to her. But her husband sure did. And I bet you that was conversation around the kitchen table for many a night and many a year. Donna Sebo here. We're taking a break. 888-627-6008. We're going to be right back. Don't go away.
Have you ever had a friend tell you about a product they really believed in? Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Toprosin is a homeopathic cream that is just fabulous. I use it and my friends use it for relief of painful discomfort such as aching muscles and sore feet. Odorless, non-greasy, it is a product that belongs in everyone's medicine cabinet and first aid kit. Check out www.toprosin.com. That's T-O-P-R-I-C-I-N. And find out more information. You can order Toprosin online or call 800-959-1007. That's 800-959-1007. Be sure to give them the code DS30 and you'll receive a 30% discount. Toprosin, non-toxic, safe for children too. This is a product that really works. Try it. I think you'll like it.
Do you have children between the ages of 3 to 10? Do you love children's books and collect them? Then you'll want to know about God's Kiss, the award-winning illustrated children's book that has been enjoyed by families around the world. 15 beautiful illustrations by Pacific Northwest artist Ed Gedrose accompany this lovely story about a little boy named Johnny that will capture your heart and mind in a very special way. Multicultural and non-denominational in content, it will become a family favorite that you and your children will want to read again and again. This book is available by itself through Amazon, or if you contact me, Donna Sebo, directly, you can get a personalized signed copy. There is also a talking book. You can order the talking book CD by contacting me via email, donna@delphiinternational.com, or by calling 253-582-5604. You can also visit my website, delphiinternational.com, to see more details. God's Kiss is a family classic that belongs in everyone's library. Get your copy now.
Hi, this is Donna. Okay, before I share some goodies with you today, which, by the way, I thought I would share with you a three meat pasta sauce. This is good stuff. And if you're like me, you're just always looking for something a little bit different, I think this is going to be good. But anyway, so get yourself a pad of paper and a pen if you would like to copy it down. I want to give you things that are coming up and events. I am going to be on February the 25th, which is this upcoming Saturday. I'm going to be at the East West Bookshop, and I'm going to be there at 7 p.m. We're going to be talking about the Power Mind program. There's a $15 admission. I'm going to be there. I'm also going to be doing mind demonstrations. It's going to be a lot of fun. It is really something I love to do. So that's in Seattle at the East West Bookshop. And then, before we know it, March 2nd, 3rd, and 4th, it's the Pacific Northwest Women's Show. I've been participating in this event for 12 years, and I'm telling you, I love it. Every year, there's something fabulously new. And one, I have a forum on Friday where I'm going to feature five very special speakers. And you can go to my website, find out more about that at DelphiInternational.com. But also, I'm going to be there doing many consultations. And then on Sunday, I'm going to be talking about Spirit Talk, and that's going to be at 11:30 in the morning. So if you're in the Pacific Northwest, check it out. This is a fabulous event. Go to Northwest Women's Show, nwwomenshow.com, and you are going to find out all kinds of things. Bring a pal. Gals, it's absolutely awesome. And guys, if you just love learning about women, this is a wonderful event to come to. But ladies, I'm telling you, get your girlfriends. It's a blast. And I'm in booth 407. Come by and say hello. I'd love to meet you. So that is what is coming up. And my goodness, I didn't think that my schedule was going to be as wild and crazy as it is. But I wanted to share with you today this three meat pasta sauce. Now, remember, this is sort of a basic recipe. And what I like about this recipe is that you can make this up And then what you don't want to use, you can freeze in the freezer. And do you ever get wild and woolly and crazy with your schedule? I do, and I'm sure you do. So what I'd like for you to do is keep in mind, you can put this into storage containers. You can either, when it's cooled, you can put it in plastic bags, you know, sort of flatten a little bit, stick it in your freezer, let it get hard as a rock, and then you've got it whenever you need it. Or you can put it in, you know, some other containers that you like. But it's really, really great to have. And you can doctor this in a number of different ways. So let me give you the basic recipe. You're going to need 3 tablespoons of olive oil, 3 tablespoons of olive oil. You need a large onion, chop that up, big pieces, little pieces, whatever's your preference. You're going to need 2 ribs of celery, and I'd recommend you finely chop the celery. 2 carrots, chopped, or if you want, grated. Depends on how you want this texture in your sauce. 2 cloves of garlic, mince it. You're going to need 8 ounces of ground beef, 8 ounces of ground pork, and 8 ounces of ground lamb. Now, each of these meats give their own particular texture and flavor to the sauce. If you don't care for any one of these meats, substitute something else. It's just that simple. But there will be a difference in the flavor. 2 tablespoons of tomato paste, 2 tablespoons of tomato paste, 1/2 teaspoon of salt, 1/4 teaspoon of freshly ground pepper, 1/2 cup of dry white wine, and you need 2 cans, 28 ounces each, of peeled tomatoes. If you want to get the Italian kind, great, get that. If you just want to get the ordinary peeled tomatoes, get that. Doesn't make any difference. Now, what does make a difference, though, and I neglected to mention this, it should be the peeled tomatoes in a tomato puree, and you want to take those tomatoes and puncture them and then just chop them up. It's really easy. You can do that with a fork right up against the inside of the bowl that you put this in. Just have fun with this. This isn't a big deal. Now, this is what you do. In your skillet, you heat your oil over medium heat. You're going to add your onion, your celery, your garlic, and your carrots, all of that. You cook that until it's tender and golden. But you don't want it to get brown. You don't want to brown this. You just want it so that it's just, it's not quite al dente, but you want it just barely tender. Now, when the onion starts to color, you want to be sure that you add a little bit of water because you want it translucent. You don't want to have it brown again. Then you want to put in your beef, your pork, and your lamb. You cook it. You stir with the back of a spoon. You break it up into lumps until it's all mixed nicely. You want that to brown lightly. Stir in your tomato paste, salt, and pepper. Add your wine, and you bring the mixture to a simmer. Then you take your tomatoes with the puree, put it into a big crock pot if you've got it, or if you're going to do this on top of the stove, it's a big pot that you need, and you want it on very, very low heat, and then you put your meat and vegetable mixture in there, stir it, cover it, and in your crock pot, you can cook it on high for about 4 hours or on low for 8 hours until the sauce gets nice and thick. And if you're going to do it on the top of the stove, make sure it's on extremely low heat. And let me tell you, this smells so good. Now, what I would do with this sauce, I would add, and this is just me because of my Italian background, fennel seed, oregano, maybe a little basil. Don't be afraid to add your own spices that you like. You can make it Italian, make a Mexican flavor, you can make it Greek. There's so many things you can do with this recipe. It's a good basic sauce. Well, my goodness, we're almost out of time. Donna Sebo here. I'm so delighted you've been able to join me. Now, tomorrow we're going to be talking about how you can publish your own book. Dan Poynter is considered one of the leading experts on self-publishing, and he's going to be with us tomorrow. So I hope you'll join us. And if you've got a friend that wants to do something like that, tell them about the show so that they can turn in too. And, well, what can I say? We're going to be here live tomorrow, and I want to thank you so much for being with me. Remember, always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. This is Donna Sebo. God bless. Have a magnificent day or evening wherever you are. I'll see you back here tomorrow on bbsradio.com. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.